one of the things we do at Women with a Vision, these are the kind of policies that we look at. Because oftentimes the community itself will think, yeah, get them off the street, not understanding what consequences it has once anyone enters the criminal justice system, especially for something that really is not a crime of another person. More, it's what you do for yourself. And many of our clients at Women with a Vision are, I know we are a part of the sex worker rights movement, but I can honestly tell you many of the clients that we work with, for them it's about survival. Many of them have experienced years of trauma. Many of them are homeless. Many of them are struggling with addiction. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, this happens because, you know, they entered at age 12. Well, not everybody enters sex work at age 12. We have clients, given the economic decline or whatever's happening in this country right now, we have clients who started sex work at 45 years old because they had no other choice once they lost their job. And when we start criminalizing people for personal behavior, it has this overarching outcome that also affects their public health. Because, see, if you are have a felony conviction, or if in, like in Louisiana, if you are a registered sex offender, then it's not really easy for people to offer you service or for you to access service. And the level of shame and trauma that went along with women walking into a place or even looking for a job. We had clients that went into McDonald's, and every day, if you can imagine what it's like to pull out your rap sheet and have to say, I really didn't hurt a child. I didn't hurt anyone. I simply was involved in prostitution for whatever reason to a McDonald's manager, and them say, we don't hire your kind of people. Or for women in the transgender, for transgender women especially, it's even more difficult because it's the whole stigma of being transgender. And many people have said, we've asked employees like, why? Well, we don't think the community will accept them. And police, all our transgender clients, and this is across the country, where most transgender people say, we're guilty of walking while trans. So even if you're not doing anything, if a police officer automatically just sees you, they automatically assume that transgender women are involved in sex work because that's what they do. And so one of the things we did here in Louisiana is we got a coalition together, and it was titled No Justice, and we challenged the state's crime against nature laws. We work with the Center of Constitutional Rights. We work with public health professionals. We challenged the law, and we actually won. So we had a legislative win. And so this past year, over 800 individuals were taken off of the sex offender registry. They're supposed to clap for that. Legislative wins. Legislative wins don't happen in Louisiana. They don't happen across this country, but they don't happen in Louisiana like talking about it. But we were able to build a case. And the case was really built on how this was affecting public health. How this was affecting the overall public health, but not just their public health, but economically, what this was, you can't find a job. We had a client who was 23 years old, and I consider her my favorite client because I had worked with her for many years. And she had been on the streets since she was 14 years old. When she was 19, she said, I'm going to follow society's rule, Ms. Deanna. I'm going to get it right. And so she went to treatment. She got her GED. She was doing well. She was so excited because people like us, and I say society, us, tell them, do this, do the right thing, go to school, and it'll all make your life better. Well, guess what? She can't go to school because she's a convicted felon. So she can't get assistance for school, and she damn sure can't afford it. So you want to know what she's doing? She's dancing still in the French Quarter to this day. And so this is why we have to make sure that structural violence, when you hear the word structural violence, it is about having a safe place to live, but it's also making sure that the criminal justice system is not entering places where they should not be, where it keeps people, what puts women and transgender women at risk for HIV, because if you can't get a job and you can't take care of yourself, then there's only one thing that people are going to do that. And so moving forward, we feel like it is an important piece of our work to make sure we use those three frameworks that I talked about, that we are now involved in so many aspects of the criminal justice system I never thought we would be involved in. Over the last 2 years, we started the Racial Justice Improvement Project, and we have public health professionals. We're the community partner, the DA's office, the NOPD, and municipal court judge. And so we started a diversion program, and so we're trying to eliminate women and transgender women going into prison for sex work, and we're just trying to build a system of services for them. And lastly, I don't know if some of you heard, but this week in the great city of New Orleans, the New Orleans Police Department had a report issued on them. And after Hurricane Katrina, just to say the New Orleans Police Department is under a consent decree under the Department of Justice means that they are no good, meaning that you cannot govern yourself. We have to come in. So the feds have came in to govern them. But even with the federal government stepping in, this week we got a report from the Independent Police Monitor's Office where NOPD, the five officers in our sex crime unit, falsified over 1,000 cases. So they misreported rape, they misreported child abuse in cases where DNA and other evidence was there, and there could have been a case and a conviction. And so when you talk about why women don't report, why women don't speak up, if the systems that are in place to protect us really don't. And it was so egregious where there was a three-year-old who went into the emergency room with the STD. They did not report it. They issued it as miscellaneous, and they actually came back and said the victim couldn't give us any information. The victim was three. One police officer in the sex crime, and I'm going to end it here and go to questions, but one police officer who was female, the only female officer, said, I don't even know why I have to investigate cases where women are unconscious. So what? I don't think that's a crime. I don't see how that's rape. She can't say no or yes. And so this is why fighting violence against women and sexual assault against women is so important. It is why the marriage of public health, because APHA is changing. The fact that I'm standing here says that we are changing. But this is why it's important to marry all our movements together so we can make a difference for women and transgender women. Thank you.
Thank you, Dionne. I think you raised many issues because the women you talked about actually face a triple whammy, which is awful. And let's hope that one day, at least future generations can say this is a thing of the past. Wishful thinking. But now we have almost 18 minutes for Q&A and interaction. What I would request is if you have a Q&A, or you want to make a comment, please raise your hand. Introduce yourself and say which of the panelists you would like answer, or if it's for the whole panel, the person who thinks like they can answer it best, and sometimes we have more than one answer. So thank you all. It was really nice, and I think thank you, ladies. Great job. So the floor is open now for questions. Yes, could you please introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Jenya Shimkin, and I'm from Seattle, Washington. I do a lot of work with queer and transgender youth around I guess my question is for Dionne, though anyone else is obviously free to chip in. And I think you raised a really interesting point at the end there where you were talking about the new report with the five police officers, one of them being women, a woman. Mm-hmm. And I think so often we frame violence against women as a man's issue, and not men who perpetrate violence against women.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to this piece about women who perpetrate violence against women, either because they're caught in a structure that forces that upon them, or because they don't make the link.
Yeah, that's not. I think we can scream.
I can be loud. So this Saturday morning I was on Nerdland on Melissa Harris Perry because she did a report on the actual report that came out this week. And her question to me was, do you think this is, you know, just kind of the culture of NOPD? And my answer was really, this is embedded in the culture across this country about how we all treat each other. I'm going to step out on a limb because it's probably the easiest way I can give you my answer. You know, in the African American community, we have a difference in the way we talk about racism that exists from outside. And then there's a thing that's called internalized racism, how we see ourselves, how society has allowed us to see ourselves, and we mirror that back to each other in a way that's not how it should be. And I think that's similar how it is with women. You know, we don't talk enough, and there are not enough domestic violence or gender-based violence programs in this country that talk about same-sex violence. We don't talk about it. We don't talk about what that looks like. And patriarchy, I'm sorry, is alive and well. And the examples of how you should treat your woman exist. And so I think it has to be, and that's why I think we have to have many approaches on how we deal with it. And we have to talk about it more and allow spaces to talk about that.
Thank you so much. Does anybody else have any other questions or comments? Yes, could you please introduce yourself?
Sure, my name is Ashley Hickman. I am a PhD student at Arizona State University. I'm curious, actually, I guess anyone can answer that I've worked with police, but I'm especially curious about the women's police unit in Bihar and how those were established and how they function and if they're in rural areas. Because I work in Nepal and the rural police outposts or the rural police outposts.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, it was first started off by having it in an urban area. It was pretty successful. And Bihar is one of the most patriarchal states in India, where they have a lot of strict gender norms and, you know, like, this is what a woman can do and a lot of stereotyping for gender roles. But it was actually pretty successful. And after that, they kind of had it not exactly in a rural area, the other precincts which they did staff with women officers, but kind of at the border, which was easily accessible. And because of this, they're even now, I think, replicating it in other areas as well. And I think, I remember reading a report based on the success of this, that they were thinking even of introducing these in certain Latin American, Central American countries because, you know, where there is a lot of abuse, but it's not really acknowledged. So that is one of the success stories, I guess, if I could use that term using success stories. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Dr. Dara, you had a question for us.
I'm Ramana Dara, and I'm from the Center for Disease Control Prevention. I want to bring up the issue of Timothy about the rape of women in India. And I don't know if people are aware of this fact that there was a woman called Jyoti Singh Pandey, a very young woman who was in New Delhi, who was raped and murdered in New Delhi. And this particular incident gained international headlines. And what happened was that the media was then full of opinion, op-eds and things like that as to, you know, what's going on here? Why is it particularly here that it's going on? And then they said probably the incidence of rape is not any greater in India as compared to, you know, other countries. But one of the very interesting insights that came out was that in India there is a culture of male children being beaten when they are young. And somehow this seems to have sort of resulted in this, these male children growing up and then transferring this violence against the women who are the most vulnerable. So violence really transfers towards the people who are most vulnerable. So why are these male children being treated like this? And I'm trying to see if anybody on the panel or anybody in the audience has any data to tell us why, whether these men who are, you know, doing the violence against the women, have they been beaten as children? And is there any correlation with what's going on there? The fact that they've been beaten as children and they then become violent as men. So if anybody has any data, I'd be interested in getting that.
Excuse me, could you please introduce yourself? Thank you so much.
I'm Ilana Valeris. I'm from Atlanta. I was actually doing qualitative research on the impact of violence and connection to men being beaten as children in Vietnam this past summer, and I have a definitive analysis yet. It's about 2% of them. But it is showing a huge correlation there, and this is the qualitative data that we're looking at. It's really interesting in terms of how people are
address
how, what are disciplines around violence during the beginning, and when that happens, and why that happens, so I'll come back to you.
Very interesting.
Yeah, the question I had was, for everyone,
examples from our county jail, the idea of how we're defining gender is what would prompt someone's genitals to be searched, because we're not accepting of how people identify in their gender. So in our county jail, and I suspect this is the way it is in a lot of county jails, is that you are assigned to the unit based on your sex and not your gender. And so these are the structural challenges that Neon is talking about that actually puts all types of women at risk for greater violence. So I think there's some basic cultural understanding, basic respect, but I mean, talking about police and how they interact with citizens in general is part of the issue, in addition to the gentleman having no clue about what it is to identify as a trans or transgender person. So I think we are light years behind with our law enforcement around how they interact with LGBTQ people in general. So I'm not very optimistic at this point around the receptiveness of police departments to try to understand the different types of people in their community. So it's just, I think that trans people are at very high risk for that type of violence on the street or while they're incarcerated.
I think some working together, kind of like coalitions, advisory community boards, making a difference. And I'll back it up by saying I'm very involved. In the past 5 years, I've been a co-chair of the Westchester County, New York HIV Coalition. And that coalition had really strong representation from obviously the LGBT community, transgender community, all police, county government, the health department, Department of Social Services, and I see the seeds of, you know, of people coming together to build capacity, which gives me great hope. There's an organization in Washington, D.C. called the Bazelon Center, Be Like a Boy, A-Z-E-L-O-N, and they've actually done some grant funding for projects, I mentioned this to you, with the police departments to work within these social public health structures. So police working for social justice with some of the local, you know, coalitions. And I've seen just by going to these meetings over the past 4 or 5 years that it's beginning to make a difference. I see that some of the most intractable, you know, hard-nosed police officers, I don't mean to be bashing it, I see that through education and awareness and getting to relate to people around the table, how, you know, it really, that relationship building piece with amongst people, amongst communities, people who represent communities and constituencies.
Thank you. I'm just going to have you talk to him, but I'm going to take the last question because some of us have to schlep across the convention center where we have other presentations, even though we would love to stay here because you've been a great audience. But so, Dion, and then we'll have you, ma'am, with your last question. Please go ahead.
So I wanted to say that I would love to say I've seen a great change, like throughout the South, because we work with a lot of people throughout the South, but we haven't. Here in New Orleans, there's a group called Breakout, and they organize with LGBTQ youth, and they and Women with a Vision, we've worked really hard to do a lot of presentations to the New Orleans City Council Criminal Justice Committee, as well as trying to change some of the policies within NOPD and how they approach people. And some days it works, and many days it doesn't. I agree with Latasha that there is a culture in this country, and there definitely is a culture in the police department, in many police departments across this country, of how people are treated and how people are looked at. You know, for example, here we had we did a meeting with the New Orleans Independent Police Monitor, who monitors the police department from the outside. And we had, I think, between 26 to 28 transgender women meeting to talk about their experience with NOPD, as well as doing a Know Your Rights training with them. And so we asked the question, how many of you have been forced or in some way it's your freedom versus sex with some kind of sexual exchange. Majority of the room raised their hand, and majority of them could name and had numbers for the officers. And so I'm all for like cleaning. I'm one of those people like I like going in and cleaning stuff out. I feel like in some ways we have to be realistic. We're not going to change some people, and if they're not going to change, they need to go because they pose a greater risk.
Thank you. Last question from you.
I don't have a good question, so I'm gonna. No, I just listened to everything you guys are saying, and it's just it's okay. My question is this: I'm Rebecca Pinto. I work in Palo Alto, and I've been spending about past 4 or 5 years working on intimate partner violence screening in our clinic with Stanford students and all these different folks. So our screening levels are way up. Of course, when you screen a lot, you find a lot. And so the piece that I'm looking at you folks about is the advocation for victims. But I think that you were speaking a little bit to this, if we don't explore and if we can call it advocate for the perpetrators in a way of what the heck happened that makes you think this is okay. If we don't start going upstream, our effects downstream are never going to have quite the oomph, because the social construct of discrimination that you were speaking of, Christine, is always going to be there. If we don't, you know, we've got to split ourselves, and we've got to help and be compassionate and work with people that have been victims of all this, but we also have to figure out how we're going to manage up and get stuff going on for kids and get stuff going on for perpetrators so that in 3 decades we don't have another generation of folks that are willing to hit and hurt.
Thank you. You bring up a very important issue, and I think due to time constraints, it's like each of us would have liked to talk more. But yes, there are some programs, especially by some NGOs. And Canada has launched a great program called the White Ribbon Program, where men who were, you know, abused as children, what you brought up, Dr. Dora, like they are being integrated and kind of like, you know, having like therapy. And so it's men working with men and women to address issues. So there are efforts. Definitely, we cannot be successful if you only look at one side of the coin. So thank you all so much, and enjoy NOLA. And I'm sorry, we got to run because we need to go there.